This is an LA Times Studios podcast.
But yeah, I mean, these housewives' transition to prison has to be the most nightmare that they've ever experienced in their life.
I can't even imagine, like, what, you know, especially, like, when Giselle said, like, you know, they don't allow wigs in prison. So, you know, what's Karen going to do? So, yeah, I'm sure she's not having a great time. I mean, I'm sure we've all thought about, like, what would I do? Like, what would I wash my face with? Like, is it just bar soap? Like, I don't know.
Hello and welcome to LA Crimes. I'm your host, Madison McGee, and today I'm joined by my friend and radio host and founder of The Talk of Shame, Kiki Monique. Kiki, how's it going?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm good. I'm so excited. Thank you for joining me. Today on the show, we're going to talk about the Tom Girardi case, the lawyer husband of Real Housewife Erika Jayne, who just got convicted of financial fraud. Later, we'll interview Los Angeles Times investigative reporter Harriet Ryan, who, with Matt Hamilton, were key in bringing some of Girardi's crimes to the public. Kiki, why is this case such a big deal?
I mean, I think it's such a big deal because Tom Girardi was such a major public figure in California. And Erika Jayne is one of the most popular housewives of our generation.
So how did you get into giving people the news they're nosy about?
You know, it was actually COVID. I mean, I know COVID and lockdown was a really dark time, but I thrived. It was great. You know, everyone was kind of at equal footing zero. Nobody had jobs. Nobody had anything to do. So we all got on TikTok, right? And I wasn't a singer, lip syncer, or dancer. So the only thing I could do was talk. And there weren't a lot of talkers during that time. And so I would just talk on TikTok. And I got into it and just spill some tea. And then I really got into the true crime stuff when the Johnny Depp Amber Heard trial happened, because I realized, you know, I'm really into the law. I'm not a lawyer, but I like to break things down for people like me in a layman way. And so I just started reporting on that every day, and people seemed to love it. So I just got more into it.
Yeah, I love that. I've actually been with you when some, like, news was dropping about the Blake Lively, Justin Baldini stuff. And I remember you going, I can't really talk about this right now because I have to read the whole thing first. And I'm like, what? You're going to read the entire thing? I mean, you're so thorough, even though it's like tea, reality, sort of this like entertainment news. I mean, you're doing like deep dives into these cases so that people can get a summaried version of it.
Yeah, and I think that was originally what set me apart. I think everyone now knows, like, you can go and pull complaints and do those sorts of things, but nobody was really doing that before. And, you know, figuring out how to set myself up on a Pacer account and going to the Los Angeles system and just figuring all that out and downloading all of those documents that are readily available and you just got to read them, it really allows you to dive into the actual case itself, because a lot of times you're reading headlines and just tickers and you're like, oh, that's what I'm going to post, or a lot of these accounts, that's what they post. But you're like, when you get into the details, you're like, wait, there's more to the story here, and people need to understand all of these nuances.
Yeah, no, I love that. And that's like such a fun bridge between the things that like we love, which is reality TV, and journalism. And I mean, you're investigating this stuff so that the people who watch Bravo know what's going on. You're doing the Lord's work, really, especially for me. Now that we're in church, let's open our Bibles to the first segment, Hot Goss, where we talk about all things criminal in reality TV. It's so fascinating to me how much crime happens literally right before our eyes. And let's dive into that.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much crime on reality TV, it seems, recently. And people are always like, why? If you knew that you had these troubles, why would you come onto reality TV? But honestly, I feel like it's because when you're in a situation, when you're in a predicament, reality TV is sort of a way to make quick cash. And a lot of time, these people, they're having financial issues and they need to figure out, you know, how to get the quickest, you know, cash the quickest. And I think that's why they're willing to do it. They're willing to risk it all. Also, you know, in certain cases, I think if they know they're in trouble, becoming a reality star, think about it. If you know you're going to get arrested, would you rather be arrested as a nobody or would you rather be arrested as a reality star where you might have fans and people on your side? I don't know. You might be willing to do it.
That is so interesting, because I've always sort of looked at it from the angle of like, you could have gotten away with it probably. And then you put yourself on TV and then it's like some stranger on Reddit's like, wait, that's the guy that owes me money. And they would have never known otherwise. But it is interesting to think then you have sort of this court of public opinion, which I feel like is going to be a theme. It was a theme on the last episode. I feel like it's a theme now in true crime. The court of public opinion is serving as like an extra jury member. And that fandom can really help you. I mean, we're looking at Jen Shah getting out of prison early and people awaiting her arrival back to Salt Lake City. And that's so crazy to me. But I think that her having that to sort of live for is giving her good behavior in prison, which is going to get her out early. And it really does contribute to all of this stuff. So let's talk about some cases in reality TV. Obviously, Jen Shah, who's besties with Elizabeth Holmes, which is a reality show I need immediately.
Yeah.
But what are some of your like top Bravo or reality TV in general court cases that have been passing your desk?
I mean, obviously the Jen Shah case was amazing because we saw that unfold on camera. We see her in the Sprinter van. She gets the phone call. She looks at the camera and then she leaves, you know, saying, makes up some excuse of why she has to leave. And then we find out she's down the road getting arrested. And then we find out, you know, it's because she's been defrauding elderly people. It's all horrible. So obviously we followed that very closely, especially since she went into the next season just declaring her innocence and was just, you know, adamant she was innocent. And then she turns around, actually, I'm going to go ahead and plead guilty. You know, so we were glued to that. Obviously with the Tom Girardi, you know, that was a huge thing that blew up. Real Housewives of Beverly Hills, the Erica Jane of it all. I could not be invested because it was just so huge. And Tom Girardi himself was such a big public figure in LA. He was almost like, you know, another sort of like leader in LA because of his statue. So of course we had to follow that. I mean, obviously back in the day when Teresa, you know, and Joe Giudice went to jail. I mean, that was crazy. And again, the Bravo fans waited for them. They waited to even film for her to get out of prison. And so there was like sort of a precedent set of we will wait for you to come out and continue this story and you know, see if you learned anything in prison.
It's so interesting how, yeah, we get this sort of bird's eye view once the case is done and they're out and there's all, you know, they're making content from their experience. So I am actually very curious to see what happens with Jen Shah specifically once she gets out. If she's going to, I think she'll do the show, obviously, if they'll have her. And we kind of saw that with Erica Jane as well, sort of the aftermath of, I mean, she doesn't show as much of her life, I think, but we got to see sort of her downsize,
yeah,
and sort of the aftermath of that. And I think it's really interesting to see that. But now she's made the decision not to come back.
No, I mean, it's not as far as I know. She's
She's still coming back.
I can't imagine Erica Jane ever not coming back to Beverly Hills.
She needs the check, right?
She absolutely needs the check because this isn't over for her. Sure, she's able to use Real Housewives of Beverly Hills as a vehicle to spin her narrative because right now she's like, see you guys, I'm in the clear. You know, Tom has now been sentenced. You know, he's going away and I'm all good. But that's not really the case. There are still several cases that she's going to have to fight and they're coming up soon, some of them. And so it'll be interesting to see, you know, if she's on the next season, if she will, you know, be introducing that. I mean, now that we know we've lost Garcelle, who is sort of like critical in asking those questions, will any of the Beverly Hills housewives ask Erica those questions as she's going through it? I don't know. I guess we'll have to see next season.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really interesting how you can, for some people, you can sort of fall into the fame and you're able to sort of sneak out of it right away. And then, I mean, especially with these shows, by the next season of the next franchise, there's someone else who's done something and yeah, everyone's attention just reverts to the new thing.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I really don't even spend a lot of time thinking about Jen Shah unless her sentence is reduced.
Well, right now, Karen Huger is in a jail cell right now for a DUI conviction. And I haven't thought about her in forever, but I'm like, oh, my God, where is Karen? She's just like eating her prison lunch. She's just on the yard. Like, what is Karen Huger doing?
Yeah, it's really crazy. I mean, I saw that photo of Jen Shah and Elizabeth Holmes with her like wearing like a Walkman or something. And I had to like zoom in on her face and I'm like, are they letting her get work done in there? Like, is she okay? Like, what's going on? But I don't think about that all the time unless like there's something that pops up. But yeah, I mean, these housewives transition to prison has to be the most nightmare that they've ever experienced in their life.
I can't even imagine what, you know, especially like when Giselle said, like, you know, they don't allow wigs in prison. So, you know, what's Karen going to do? So, yeah, I'm sure she's not having a great time. I mean, I'm sure we've all thought about like, what would I do? Like, what would I wash my face with? Like, is it just bar soap? Like, I don't know.
Kiki and I will be back in just a moment to talk about the Girardi trial. But first, let's take a quick break. Welcome back to LA Crimes. I'm joined by radio host and reality TV expert, Kiki Monique. Let's dive into our next segment, From Suits to Jumpsuits, where we talk about lawyers who do really bad things. So we know a little bit about Tom Girardi being, you know, husband to Real Housewife Erica Jayne, but walk me through this case and what he did.
I mean, honestly, it's so layered and complex. But from like a top level, you know, Tom Girardi had become sort of like the good guy lawyer. He was fighting for the little guy. Back in the day, the reason he became so famous was because, you know, the whole Aaron Brockovich movie, the PG&E explosion, he became like the lawyer that won like the biggest settlement. But that's what really put his name on the map. And then he was known for going after these big entities on behalf of the small guys, you know, putting together these collective, you know, groups of people to come after and getting these huge million-dollar settlements. In 2018, there was a Lion Air crash. It was in Indonesia. Everyone on board died. You know, obviously, this is where the whole widows, orphans, you know, a lot of deaths. And when you have a case like that, essentially a lot of lawyers come to the families and they all try to represent them. So there was multiple lawyers representing families. Essentially what happened is they win a big settlement against Boeing for this air crash. And, you know, the lawyers have to pay out, you know, based on, you know, what is earned. And essentially Jay Edelson, who was one of the attorneys who had partnered with Girardi, essentially, it's like he didn't get paid and he realized there was something going on. So he sued Tom Girardi. And that's sort of like what got the ball rolling. And then LA Times is really the one, you know, Matt Hamilton and Harriet, you know, they're bringing it to the public attention. They really dove into the details of like, what has Tom Girardi been up to? And they found all of these other cases. And they wrote up a story. And that's what, you know, when we see in Real Housewives of Beverly Hills, Sutton saying, did you see this big story? And Kyle's like, it's too long. I didn't read it. You know, that was the story that really broke it open for, you know, me, like the Bravo fans of the world who hadn't been, you know, involved in that. But as this case, you know, unfolded, what we learned is Tom Girardi has essentially had a Ponzi scheme going for years, because when you work these kind of cases where you're getting big settlements, you're supposed to get the money and it goes into a trust account. And that trust account is not to be touched at all. You know, that is the money that is to go to the client. And the only money that can be taken from that is the expenses, because a lot of times these lawyers work on contingency and they have to justify the expenses and they take it out and then the rest goes to the client. But what we learned throughout this trial is that Girardi and Keese, they were spending well above what they were bringing in. And so money was coming out of this settlement account and there wasn't enough money going to the clients. But he had so many big cases because he was such a big name. He always had money going into his trust account. So he was essentially robbing Peter to pay Paul. So even though he had spent this one client's money, okay, client B's money came in. He was able to finally pay client A, but then client B was looking for their money. He's like, okay, we need to get client C. So he had to wait for that settlement to come in and then client B would get paid, but then client C was looking for the money. And that's really what was happening, is there was just money going out. And as we dig into the expenses and how Girardi Keese was living this lavish lifestyle, again, a lot of this played out on Real Housewives of Beverly Hills. We saw the Pasadena estate. We saw the private airplane. And then people started wondering, like, well, was Erica funding her entire lifestyle on stolen money? And I think that is why people are like, look, Erica, I understand you were a sugar baby. You were taken care of. A lot of people in the Girardi Keese world were being taken care of by this money. What we're saying is that maybe you need to give some of it back.
Yeah, no, I think that's a big question that a lot of people have, is did Erica know? Yeah. And I think, obviously, I don't know the answer to that, but I do think, yeah, maybe there was this level of something felt a little funny. I don't know if, you know, not to insult her intelligence, I don't even think I would understand all the ins and outs. Like, oh, the money came into my account because of this and this and this. So I don't think she knew really to the full extent anyways, because it was probably so complicated.
Yeah.
Regardless. But yeah, I think there would have been a level of, this feels strange. And you're the type of lawyer who shouldn't be rich, right? Like, there's like lawyers that make a lot of money because they do a certain type of law that like warrants that. There are corporate attorneys who work in-house for a big company or something. But when you're representing people like this, you shouldn't have $20 million to like move around anyway. So that would just feel a little strange to me.
Yes and no, but only because he was fighting these huge corporations, getting these billion-dollar settlements. And these contingency fees are like 40%.
Yeah.
So, but again, you know, that 40% is supposed to be taking care of your overhead expenses in addition to your salary.
Everything. That's so that's not when your payout.
Yeah. And so, you know, again, the trial was just so interesting because that is where you got into, Tom knew something more was happening, and it did feel like he was putting people in place to make sure that he wasn't found out by keeping them almost in the dark. Because the money that was flying out of that pace, when you saw the numbers that were just like all over the place and the expenses that they had, it was just disgusting when you realize how many clients didn't get their actual settlement checks. And I mean, these are people who were maimed, harmed, had dead family members, and they just are left with nothing.
There is this connotation, I guess, of sort of like white collar criminal versus sort of a criminal. So, you know, if Tom Girardi or Jen Shaw murdered someone, we'd be having maybe a different conversation. Maybe not, because they're famous, but there's a debate online, like, what Jen Shaw did really that bad?
Yeah.
And because it's financial versus like taking a life or like physically harming someone. And then other people are like, these are old people who didn't know that their money was being stolen from them. How do you navigate that? And how do you think the public views these cases because of sort of their severity in their mind?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really hard for people, especially when it gets down to numbers and finances and those sorts of things, because it's not glamorous. It's not exciting. I mean, look, I've been following the Tom Girardi trial, and I noticed the minute that Erica wasn't involved in the criminal case, sort of public interest fell off. You know, when I went to like every day of that Tom Girardi trial, and there weren't many people in the audience. But when you're listening to the stories of the people that were hurt and affected, yeah, they weren't, you know, murdered or they weren't maimed, but they were severely harmed. And their lives were turned upside down. And it was awful. You know, I'm watching a woman on the stand who lost her baby. And while Tom Girardi wasn't responsible for her baby's death, he was responsible for stealing the money from that baby's death. And so that's when you're, you know, when you see the mother on the stand man crying, you're like, it is horrible, but people don't see that. Because again, a lot of these white collar cases take place in federal court. In federal court, you cannot have cameras. And so people don't see it. Whereas in criminal cases, we have, you know, the court TVs of the world, we have the Law and Crime. And so people get to see, you know, what's going down. But yeah, a lot of times, you know, these white collar crimes, people just, you know, they aren't as invested.
Yeah. What was it like to be in the courtroom hearing all of this? And is there anything that really stands out to you, like number wise, a expense that was, you know, spent and you're like, what? That just stands out to me.
I mean, there were so many things. First of all, I mean, you know, Tom showed up one, you know, he showed up one day in slippers, and then you just had to wonder, because again, his lawyers were arguing that he wasn't mentally fit, you know, but they did declare him mentally fit. But, you know, him showing up in slippers, his outfits always looked just really off. He was being brought in every day from his like nursing home. So he had a nurse, you know, kind of bringing him into the courtroom. So you did feel like there was this whole like they were trying to get empathy from the jury.
And that's what's so funny about them trying to say he was not mentally fit. We're not deciding if Tom Girardi today is mentally fit. Mm-hmm. We're talking about the Tom Girardi that did all of these
exactly.
things. Exactly. So maybe he's not right now, but that, decades of doing this.
And when they, you know, when they involved, you know, the whole state bar, because again, he got disbarred, when they bring up his 40-year, you know, career, this had dated back to the 80s when clients had been complaining to the bar about him. On top of this, because, you know, the DA office, it's all about elections. Because there was a transfer in election, a lot of the people, because once Tom Girardi went down, there was like kind of a list of other people that they were planning to go after. But once the election came into play and sort of changing of the guard, I don't even know if the new DA or if the DA's office is going to go after those additional people. Because even though Tom Girardi was the first to fall and it should easily be able to get those other people, I don't know if they're going to go after them. So it's like, it's such a mix of like how politics and everything, it gets involved in all of this. And now, right now, Tom's just sort of sitting there in purgatory because is he going to be sentenced and will he go? I don't, you know, we don't even know yet.
Kiki, do you have any words to close us out?
No, I mean, but I love talking about true crime with you.
Same. I love it so much. Thank you so much for being here. This was incredible.
Thank you for having me.
After the break, I'll talk with LA Times investigative reporter Harriet Ryan about her and Matt Hamilton's reporting on the Girardi case and the surprising details that they uncovered. Welcome back to LA Crimes. Joining us today is Harriet Ryan, an investigative reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Thank you so much for joining me.
I'm happy to be here.
So how did you first get involved in covering the Tom Girardi case and what initially drew you to the story?
Matt, my reporting partner, Matt Hamilton, and I had both been legal reporters at some point in our career, and we both knew Tom Girardi's reputation. He was just like this towering figure in the law in the United States, but especially in Los Angeles. And we were sitting down together at the beginning of 2020 to sort of map out what kind of stories we wanted to do. And we'd always heard all this kind of weird, just tidbits about Girardi's law practice. And we were like, you know, we should finally look into that. So we put it on our list. I believe it was number 5 or 6 on our list of stories we were going to do that year. And our editor liked it. And then COVID hit. And so we had to pivot and do COVID for several months. We came back in the fall of 2020. We just started looking at, you know, what was going on with Girardi. And we realized that, like, there was a lot there. And I remember Matt saying, yeah, and you know he's married to Erica Jane. And I was like, in my mind, I was like, make sure you Google who Erica Jane is later, because I didn't know. But that was kind of what set us off on that road.
Yeah, wow. And it's, when you're first diving into it, did it seem like there was, oh, there's a little bit here, this might be an interesting story, and then underneath the surface, you unpacked, I mean, decades of this crazy scheme. What was going on in your mind when you're uncovering this?
Well, I think about being a reporter. It was when I was working at Court TV. So it was probably like the mid-2000s. I remember being in the elevator one time with him at the civil courthouse in Mosque, the big civil courthouse in downtown LA. And when we got out of the elevator, I was walking behind him down this long hall filled with attorneys and court officers and, you know, just regular people. And as I was walking behind him, people were just coming up to him, paying him homage, like left and right. And he's just like this little guy, but it was just like the power he controlled. And that's how I'd always thought of him. But when Matt and I started looking at just like the lawsuits that had been filed against him since the 80s, we realized like, this guy is like, there's so many red flags. He is like this really problematic figure. He's been sued more than 100 times. There's all this evidence that he's stealing money. What is going on here? And it's just one of those situations where no one had ever really looked. And once they started to look, they were like, this is a mess.
And from your investigating and being involved in all of these court proceedings, was Girardi performing all of this alone? Were there co-conspirators? What was the team behind all of this?
You know, the most outraging thing was the role of people that worked at the state bar. So the state bar is sort of like the police for lawyers. It's a public agency, you know, and their job is to protect the public from bad lawyers. And, you know, Girardi was very smart. He made friends with people that worked at the state bar. He gave their kids jobs. He gave their wives jobs. He took them on really lavish trips to Las Vegas. He took them on trips in his private jet. There was one investigator, he and his wife, Girardi paid them more than $1 million. So he had sort of the state bar locked up and he cultivated this very close relationship. And so when people did feel like they'd gotten robbed and they called, you know, the government officials who were supposed to help them, nothing happened. There was more than 115 complaints to the state bar and a lot of them were killed. And so those people just walked away frustrated. And the state bar is, you know, I mean, that's an important agency. It's like essentially like corrupting the police. It's like corrupting a public agency. So I feel like that's really outrageous. And without that, he could have never gotten away with this.
And then there's the Erica Jane of it all. I do watch Real Housewives, so I'm very familiar with her lavish lifestyle in the past and, you know, watching her spend hundreds of thousands of dollars on outfits for her tour. She's a pop artist. I mean, she's experimented with lots of different careers that you can only really do as a hobby when you have wealth at that level. What did you notice through the court proceedings was her role in all of this, if there was one?
It's still very murky what she knew. I mean, she says she knew absolutely nothing, that like what he said, she believed. She didn't go down there and like look through records. When she told people that, you know, he was an honorable person and that she looked up to him, she believed that. And that all of this money, and let's face it, money was the basis of the relationship. She believed this money was honestly obtained. You know, she hasn't been charged. He was charged. There are other people in his law firm that were charged. She hasn't been charged. I think that there's no question she benefited from, you know, the operation that was going on in his law firm. Whether that leads to criminal charges or not, it has to be something she reckons with. This was all sort of like built on a lie.
Yeah, the morality of it at least should take some sort of toll, you would think, on a person's mental state. What do you think was the most difficult part about convicting Girardi with the court proceedings? Was it reasonable doubt? Like, did they have enough evidence? Like, what was it, just getting him because he's old? And I know there was sort of an attempt at insanity. What do you think was the most difficult part of this?
Yeah, I mean, I don't really think there's much of a question about whether he did it or not. The question was whether he was mentally competent. So he was diagnosed with Alzheimer's. He's, you know, his family, his brother moved him into a nursing home in Orange County. He was on like the dementia care floor. And there was a whole proceeding in federal court where like his lawyer was like, let us call in all these like nurses' aides and relatives who will tell us how like he, the behavior. And a lot of it was like really disturbing. They described him like wiping feces on the wall with his socks. They described that he would say every day, like, I need to get to my firm. Who can drive me to my firm? You know? And that it's sometimes he would tell them he was working on cases and you have a legal pad and be scribbling. And when they looked at it, it would just be gibberish. Like he just spent all day just writing nonsense. So they had this hearing, and at the end of it, the judge was like, he definitely has some sort of mental problem, but I believe that he can understand the proceedings. And there were times when he did seem to understand them. He used a a swear word to address his own lawyer in my presence, but also yelled at a prosecutor in the middle of proceedings. So, you know, that was the ball game legally was really, was he competent to stand trial, not the actual trial?
Yeah. Well, and did you find that the publicity of the case really impacted a lot of the legal proceedings? We see this a lot with really high profile cases with jury selection and things like that. I mean, if it weren't for Real Housewives of Beverly Hills, this probably wouldn't have been as public. I mean, he was still a public figure, but I think Real Housewives really publicized this in a very different way to people who are very actively on the internet. So it added a layer to this. How do you think that impacted the trial, the case itself, potentially him becoming, you know, a pillar now for precedent if this happens again?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I have just been so impressed with the Real Housewives fan base because I had an idea of them because I had not watched the show. And it's like Real Housewives is usually a punchline to a lot of things. But actually, when you get in, you watch the shows and you interact with the fans, that's not what it's like at all. And I mean, what Matt and I would write these stories are about, as I just talked about, the state bar, you know, these complicated rules and ethical violations. And we would have just so much interaction from Real Housewives fans because they care about this woman and her story. And so they wanted to understand it. And I just feel like any kind of societal problem, if we just made it into a Real Housewives storyline, it could be solved. Because the intensity and the intelligence is just there.
Yeah, it's funny, this new season, I don't know if you've started watching since this all happened, but Erica is now living in a new house. She's downsized, of course. And there's a storyline this season where she is refurnishing the home so that she can get rid of the things that remind her of Tom and get new furniture. Mm-hmm. And there's this table chairs set that she has in her house. And a fan was like, that looks familiar to me. And they found that same chair from the reunion of a past season of Beverly Hills. And they're like, oh, she took the chair from the set and it's now in her living room. And I just, the memory to do that, I would never have remembered that. And yeah, to like put it together. I mean, these people are literal investigators in their own way, which is sort of an interesting, this happens a lot. We just talked about earlier in the episode, this idea that a lot of reality TV stars end up going to prison for crimes that maybe wouldn't have been illuminated had they not been on TV. And do you think that this is going to be a unique case for you, or do you foresee this potentially becoming sort of a sideline of crime reporting?
I mean, I'm not sure. I know that with like, okay, yeah, there have been. I mean, just Beverly Hills alone, there have been a lot of sort of like legal issues that have come out of that. I mean, look, let's face it. You put your life on display. You like invite the camera in. You're like, look at my perfect life, or my life that's imperfect in a very specific and sort of glamorous way. Once you invite it in, you're going to get caught if there's anything there.
So you're in Matt's investigation into the Girardi case ended up illuminating some other sort of systemic issues, specifically relating to race and the bar. And I was wondering if you could get a little bit into that.
Yeah. So, I mean, the state bar is supposed to investigate bad lawyers, and they have investigators and money to do that. And when they aren't investigating rich, high power people like Tom Girardi, it's very easy to just turn their attention to the small fry. You know, the person that doesn't have like a robust defense, can't necessarily afford a lawyer, doesn't have like the same means and resources. And so the State Bar of California, if you are a Black man who's practicing law, you're nearly four times as likely to be disbarred as a white man. And, you know, it's just like, look, like newsflash, our society is like very unfair. It has to do with many things, but one of them is just economics. If you're, there's a long time when it was hard for Black lawyers to get hired at big firms. So they went out on their own. They were solo practitioners, hung out a shingle. I'm, you know, Joe Smith, this is my law practice. You're just so much more vulnerable to in a bar investigation, which is just you, when you have to go and answer your questions, that for them, that's time you're not getting with your clients, you know? And it's just, they didn't have, I mean, look, obviously sometimes people were doing terrible things, but it just really illuminated the inequity in the system to have somebody like Tom Girardi sued more than 100 times, 155 bar complaints, you know, stealing left and right. Nothing happens. Pristine bar record. And then you have a guy, like we wrote about this in one of our stories. It was like, it was a tiny amount of money. It didn't go missing. It was just, he had a client who was, you know, mentally unwell. And he got suspended for 30 days and had like a mark on his license. And it was over like a tiny, I think $2,000. It was a tiny amount of money. So there are, when you see a Tom Girardi getting away with stuff, there's a consequence. And that consequence fell on the backs of a lot of poor lawyers in a way that I don't think anyone would say is fair.
So now that Tom has been convicted, what happens next? I mean, Erica just said on the finale of Real Housewives of Beverly Hills, you know, they want to lock him up for 80 years. And she's like, he doesn't even have 80 days left. I mean, his health is deteriorating. What is next for him?
So his sentencing, he still hasn't been sentenced, even though he was convicted last August, I believe. They, you know, the judge wanted him to have like sort of a medical workup. There's like a federal prison hospital in North Carolina. They sent him there for a couple months. I believe he's back in the dementia care facility in Orange County. They're still arguing about where it makes sense for him to serve whatever sentence he gets. It's a difficult question because there's no question, you know, the jury convicted him. He did these terrible things. And yet, taxpayers of America, do we want to pay to house this guy, or should we just like let his family continue housing him in the dementia care facility and paying the bills? So that has to be decided by a court. And at that point, a sentence will be fixed. But I mean, we're not looking at a situation where he's going to get out of prison and be like trying to practice law again. That is not happening. He's either going to be spend the rest of his life in prison or in the dementia care facility.
Yeah. Wow. Well, definitely not the ending that anyone expected when he joined as a husband of on Real Housewives of Beverly Hills. Harriet Ryan, thank you so much for joining me. This was fantastic. And thank you for the work that you're doing as a journalist.
Oh, it was really fun talking to you.
And that's it for LA Crimes. If you like this show, please rate and subscribe, and I'll see you next week. Thanks for listening to LA Crimes. If you'd like to hear more, please, please, please purchase a subscription to the LA Times podcast feed. You'll unlock weekly bonus episodes, and you'll be supporting the award-winning journalists of the LA Times. It's the best way to support the show. LA Crimes is hosted by me, Madison McGee. It's produced by Mary Knopf and Jonathan Shiflett of Studio Phonic. Our video editor is Cooper Kenward. Our associate producer is Jordan Patterson. Our video director is Julia McCabe. Our director of post-production is Patrick Stewart. And our senior sound recording engineer is Nick Norton. Ben Church is our senior coordinating producer, and Anne-Marie Hauser is our production manager. Our podcast marketing manager is Bryn Jura, and our product marketing director is Becca Dorman. Special thanks to LA Times Studios president, Anna Megzanian. President and Chief Operating Officer of the Los Angeles Times, Chris Argentieri. And Executive Editor of the Los Angeles Times, Terry Tang. LA Crimes is executive produced and created by Darius Derrickson.